It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, online harassment and threats of physical violence can have serious consequences. We'll take a look at what technology companies and lawmakers can do about the problem. Now, the number of people who say they are members of a church, synagogue, or mosque is dropping in the United States. For the first time since 1937, the Gallup poll has found that the number has fallen below 50% of respondents. For decades, that number was steady at 70%, but since the turn of the 21st century, it's fallen fairly quickly. Our next guest joins us to talk about what's happening with church membership and what it could mean for the future of religion in the United States. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to those poll numbers? What do you think it says about the state of religion in the country? If you are a leader of a faith community, we'd love to hear from you about what you're seeing in your own congregation, your own gatherings. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan Burge is an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University and a pastor in the American Baptist Church. He's the author of the book, The Nuns, that's N-O-N-E-S, where they came from, who they are, and where they are going. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what's your reaction to these numbers from Gallup?
Well, I was very excited they put the report out because it sold a bunch of books for me, so that was always a good thing. But, you know, it's an interesting question. The question, like you read, was do you happen to be a member of a church, synagogue, or mosque? And I do think that, you know, there's two things going on here. The one is obviously the rise of the religiously unaffiliated, which, you know, what my book's about. The nuns now are about 30% of the American population, so that's obviously driving some of the declines in church membership. But there's this other thing happening in American Christianity that's sort of under-discussed, and that is a lot of the growing churches in America are these non-denominational churches that sort of crop up in shopping malls and storehouses and, you know, backyards and living rooms. And they really don't place a huge emphasis on something like church membership. I mean, people can go and you can be an attendee of a church like that, but there's no formal ceremony where you declare membership in that church. They don't receive you and vote on it. So I think there's a good share of Americans today who attend church on a pretty regular basis, but would have to answer no to the question, are you a member of a church? Because they've never actually formally declared a membership.
And both of those things you just said, somebody might be going to a church that they're not a member of, for example, they might not be affiliated with a particular denomination or religion. That doesn't mean that these nuns are, N-O-N-E-S, again, these nuns are atheists or agnostics. They might still have faith and spirituality, just not a direct connection with that building over there.
That's a very good point. And I think, you know, in the book, I kind of make this distinction. There's three types of nuns. There's atheists, which are 6% of the population. There are agnostics, which are another 6% of the population. But then there's this third group that no one really talks about. And the title of this group is Nothing in Particular, because that's actually the option on the survey they choose, which is the last option at the bottom of all your choices. It goes atheist, agnostic, then nothing in particular. 21% of Americans choose the nothing in particular option now. It's tied for the largest religious group in America today with evangelicals and Catholics. And they are a group that is drastically different than atheists, agnostics. You know, in terms of church attendance, about 35% of them go to church at least once a year or more, compared to atheists where it's less than 3% or agnostics where it's less than 6%. So really, when we talk about the nuns, most nuns are not atheists or agnostics. They're the people who look at that survey question, think to themselves for a second, and then shrug and then check the nothing in particular box because they really just don't feel strongly about religion one way or the other.
Now, we've heard about this bowling alone phenomenon by a sociologist who says, hey, Americans, and I think a lot of surveys back this up, Americans aren't joining things in general, a bowling league, a Rotary, whatever it might be. Do you see a decline in affiliation with a particular religious congregation being part of that wider trend of us in the United States being less joiners than we used to be?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a trend, you know, in that the Putnam book, Bowling Alone, the one you referenced, came out in the 1990s, and he argues that really the culprit there was cable television, which seems so quaint, you know, to look back on now, because today if Putnam wrote that book, I think it would be called like Tweeting Alone or Facebooking Alone or Netflixing Alone, right? I think whatever cable television did, it was accelerated by the rise of the internet, and then it's been even more accelerated by the rise of apps on your cell phone that make it easier to feel like you're being social without really being social, right? And I think it's pretty clear that most membership organizations in America, whether it be the VFW, the American Legion, the Moose, the Elks, and churches, are all suffering from this larger, you know, phenomenon that's happening in America where people just don't like being social anymore. They're looking for a reason to stay home, watch Netflix, be by themselves, and then sort of kind of have a pseudo socialization by what they're posting online. But we know in the social science, it's clear on that. It is not, what you do online does not replace a face-to-face in-person social interaction.
We're talking to Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, pastor in the American Baptist Church, author of the book The Nuns, about people who are religiously unaffiliated. And we're talking about new numbers from Gallup saying a growing number of Americans, over half now, are not members of a particular religious congregation. Ryan, I want to talk to you about that non-denominational phenomenon. Is there something different about a religious experience of being an actual member of, say, the Baptist church in town or the Methodist church in town versus that non-congregational, non-denominational one where I'm not a member? I show up when I show up. I don't necessarily make any further connection with that institution.
Yeah, I think there's pretty significant differences. What we're seeing in America, in 1996, about 4% of all Americans were non-denominational Christians. And today, it's about 12%. So a tripling in the last 22 years or so. And at the same time, like the largest Protestant denomination in America is the Southern Baptist Convention. It had 16.5 million members in 2006, and now it's down to 14.5 million members today. So, you know, as we're seeing, what we're seeing a lot is as people leave a church like the Southern Baptist Convention, they'll go to a non-denominational church, which interestingly enough, theologically is almost exactly the same as their Southern Baptist roots where they came from. But in terms of style, they like the idea that there's no denomination somewhere out there. What we realized about Americans and authority is that Americans don't like authority that's out there somewhere, like some far away, you know, national headquarters somewhere, but they like authority that's close by. You know, you see this on surveys. When you ask people, do you like Congress as a whole? No one likes Congress as a whole in America. But if you ask people if they like their individual member of Congress, they love their individual member of Congress. They think it's everyone else causing all the problems, but their local group is doing all the good work. And I think non-denominationals are really tapping into this idea of, I don't trust a national denomination, but I trust my pastor to lead our congregation. And I'm actually, we have a book we're writing right now, myself and a co-author, where we find that non-denominational churches are really good at creating a small circle of concern. Most non-denominational churches are care about their membership and maybe their community, but really don't have any sort of way to reach out to maybe their state or the nation, or let's say there was a tsunami somewhere in Southeast Asia. They have really no mechanisms in place to reach out and help people across the world. These denominations have spent hundreds of years and hundreds of millions of dollars setting up networks across the world to help people in need, and just non-denominationals don't have that same network set up.
Yeah, you've, I think, written about this topic a lot of here in the Midwest. A lot of social service organizations that might partner with the government or private companies have, you know, Catholic or Lutheran in their name. Is there a concern that if those denominations are declining, that a lot of services that have come to be really part of the fabric of communities are going to be in trouble?
Yeah, I think, you know, for a lot of what churches do is sort of uncovered, undercovered, submerged. We don't realize how many churches in small towns provide food for kids on the weekends, or, you know, clothes closets, you know, coat drives, you know, little summer activities for kids to do. And, you know, I understand that some people are not religious and don't see the theological value in church, and that's totally okay. But we have to understand that churches, many churches in America, do provide some, you know, some service, community service to people, especially people in poverty in their communities. And so when these churches go away, what are they going to be replaced by? Now, I would be completely happy if some atheist organizations got together and created these social service organizations. I have seen no evidence of that happening on a national scale yet. But if they don't step in, then the government's going to step in. And I think for a lot of people, they think that idea is even more repugnant than a religious group they disagree with stepping in. So there's going to be a change in society in the next 20 or 30 years as church gets smaller and the secular community gets bigger. Who's going to fill this void that these churches have been doing for 20, 30, 50 years? Right now, I don't see a clear lane, a clear path to get us to as much social service as we have today in 20 years.
We're looking at a continuing decline in church and other religious institution membership in the United States with Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, pastor in the American Baptist Church, author of the book, The Nuns, Where They Came From, Who They Are, and Where They're Going. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in your own community, your own congregation, maybe? Are you seeing these trends represented in who shows up at a worship service? Do you see a role, the role that some of these faith organizations play in your community? Do you volunteer via one? Are you worried about it continuing in the future? And do you have questions about the trends we're talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about a decline in church membership across the U.S. Ryan Burge is with us from Eastern Illinois University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Samantha is with us in Whitehall. Samantha, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had two things I was going to say. The first one, I go to a non-denominational in Whitehall, or outside of Whitehall there, and we're set up where we have gone all over the world, you know, our pastors have and some of our congregation, and setting it up so when he said that there's not a lot of, you know, network, that we don't, you know, people like us, whatever, don't have a lot in place. Well, I think that there are some that do, because we've started churches all over this, you know, world and helped out, and we're, you know, have a food distribution and all that stuff. So I don't agree with that. Plus, if the, you know, like the churches, do you think that it's getting more now with this COVID? Because there's some churches even in my town and probably others that haven't opened. There's one that might be opening this month sometime, but they haven't opened for a year.
Samantha, thanks a lot for the call. Lots of work with there. First of all, COVID, Ryan, and religion. Do you, it may be too soon to have numbers on it, but what are you seeing?
Yeah, so I've seen some data on cell phone tracking, which is actually really interesting and really, you know, accurate. We don't have to ask people they went to church. We know because their cell phones tell them they went to church. And the data I've seen says that we're about 90% back to pre-pandemic levels now, which means that, you know, things are getting back to normal. But I think that last 10% is going to be the hardest 10%. There's a lot of people who are still reluctant to come back, even though they've been vaccinated or are going to be vaccinated in the near future. We're still in that kind of in-between spot where we don't have herd immunity yet. We're not sure we're going to get to it anytime soon. So I do think we will probably get back to pre-pandemic levels at some point, but that point might be 6 months from now, not anytime soon. And you know what? There's actually some, you know, there's some thoughts out there that maybe we'll never get back to pre-pandemic levels. People stopped going to church for 6 months or a year and just decided, you know what? My life is no better nor worse for not going, so I'll never come back. However, there's the other theory that people are missing community. They're missing socialization. So it actually might lead to a small, you know, boom in church attendance. It's still way too early to sort that stuff out. I don't feel like we're going to have a good grasp of that for probably at least 6 more months now.
Thanks for that call. Go to Tim now in Appleton. Tim, hi.
Hi. I am loving this topic so far. My comment was this. I fall into the pagan community. So a lot of these studies and questionnaires that poll the religious community of America really leave us out entirely. So we end up falling into that non-category, even though my personal experience is that our community is both thriving and growing quite quickly. The other comment I had just listening since then was on the religious institutions doing charity instead of the government. I would actually like to see that more in the hands of public institutions than in religious institutions.
Tim, thanks for the call. So to Ryan's, to Tim's point, Ryan, about as a pagan, he ends up in a survey ending up in the nun category.
Yeah, you know, asking questions about religion is probably one of the hardest things we do in social science. And it's impossible to ask a question generally enough where you don't confuse people, but specifically enough where you don't leave anybody out. So, you know, how many options do we include is a huge problem. So we start giving you 35 options. I feel like, you know, we're going to get too confusing with people. And the pagan community is, you know, obviously a significant part of America. But in the grand scheme of things, there might be 250,000 pagans in America, which is incredibly small. There are 3 million Mormons in America, let's say. So, you know, we can't hit on all these groups. And so, unfortunately, on surveys, if you do a survey of 1,000 people, you might get two pagans on there. And we really can't do a whole lot statistically for two pagans. So right now we're sort of stuck dealing with the groups we have enough of to talk about in some broader way.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Pat next in Three Lakes. Pat, hello.
Hi, how are you? Thanks a lot for taking my call. My comment is this. I was a very I went to church 4 or 5 days a week for a good part of my life, my younger life anyway. And I think the reason why people aren't going to church anymore, or a lot of people are withdrawing from church now, is that the church and state has combined. There's a lot of politics in the evangelical church now. And I was a very conservative Christian, I've been to church a few times, and it's like hearing Tucker Carlson preach to you, you know, and it's not what I want. I want to hear Jesus Christ preach to me, not Tucker Carlson or
Pat. Or, thanks for the call. That's an interesting observation, Ryan. Do we see any signs that politics are driving people into or bringing people into churches?
Yeah, so in the 1970s, half of white weekly churchgoers were Democrats and about 35% were Republicans. And today, it's about 50% are Republicans and about 25% are Democrats. So we've seen this dramatic sort of switch in what the average white weekly churchgoer looks like. And then if we look at the data on disaffiliation, 40% of people who identify as liberal are religiously unaffiliated, and it's only about 12% of people who identify as conservative. So there's definitely a lot to be said about the fact that American Christianity, especially white American Christianity, has become very Republican over the last 20 or 30 years. And there's some evidence there that it's driven out some moderates and even liberals who would have gone to a church that's more, let's say, politically diverse. But now they're all really singing with one voice in a lot of these churches. And it makes moderates and liberals like the caller feel like they really don't belong. And so they just leave because it's easier to leave than try to find a liberal church because there's just not that many of them in America anymore.
Thanks for that call. And just our last 30 seconds or so, Ryan, what are you watching for next to see if these trends continue?
I'm trying to see if there's a top end, a plateau that's going to happen with the nuns. And we're starting to see that the disaffiliation rates are slowing down amongst Gen Z and millennials. They're topping out around 42 or 43% are religiously unaffiliated amongst Gen Z and millennials. I want to see if we get sort of above that 45% threshold or maybe even to the 50% threshold. It seems like we're sort of hitting a hard wall here. Then America's probably going to stop about being 45% nuns and 55% Christians, you know, Catholics, atheists or not, you know, Hindus, Muslims, Mormons, everybody else will be 55% and the nuns will be 45% in the future.
Ryan, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Ryan Burge is an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University and a pastor in the American Baptist Church. He's the author of the book, The Nuns, N-O-N-E-S, Where They Came From, Who They Are, and Where They're Going. We talked to him about the continuing decline of official church membership in the United States. On Tuesday, voters will choose Wisconsin's next state superintendent of public instruction. Former Brown Deer Superintendent Deb Kerr and Pecatonica Superintendent Jill Underley are both running to fill the seat that's without an incumbent candidate for the first time in more than 10 years. In our first of two profiles, Madeline Fox has this look at Jill Underley, the candidate backed by Democratic groups.
Like so many things over the past year, the pandemic has disrupted the politics around education, especially when it comes to virtual versus in-person learning. That's a big issue for the state superintendent candidates who face off April 6th. Deborah Kerr has been adamant that all schools should reopen as soon as possible. Her opponent, Jill Underley, has been more cautious, saying the situation may look a little different in each school district. Kerr and Underley have also taken different stances on the hot-button Wisconsin education battle that long precedes the pandemic, voucher programs for private schools. While her opponent is running as an advocate for school choice, Underley wants to freeze enrollment in the voucher program.
I'm not going to take away a voucher from a kid who currently has one. That would be incredibly disruptive. I do want to look at advocating freezing enrollment, though. I don't want the program to grow anymore because it is so expensive, and those public dollars need to stay in our public schools.
Underley has been criticized for opposing private school vouchers while sending her own kids to a private Catholic school in Madison for pre-kindergarten when she was working at the Department of Public Instruction years ago.
I wanted our kids in full day 4K and 5K. you know, when I was a working mom and my husband works also, and we needed the after school care piece. But that's a big reason why I'm running on this platform. I think all families deserve that. Our public school didn't have that option.
When she left DPI to head Pecatonica's district, Utterly expanded pre-K and childcare options to include a full-day program there. More comprehensive early childhood education is a major part of her platform, which is centered around equity for all students.
When you look at just the differences in facilities, you look at the differences in teacher salaries, you look at the differences in poverty, we know that investing in kids on the front end sets them up for a lifetime of success.
Coming out of the pandemic in particular, Underly says she'd focus on internet access and affordability, social emotional well-being for students and teachers, and how to use virtual learning for students that work better outside a physical classroom or when they can set their own pace. But the state superintendent job doesn't come with a lot of room to implement ambitious new policies, says Carroll University political scientist Lily Gorin.
The governor has particular issues that he wants to pursue in public instruction. So do members of the opposite party in the legislature. And all of those come to constrain and impact the capacity of the person who gets elected to that office.
Wisconsin also has strong local control that lets school districts call a lot of their own shots, hemming the top education official in from below. The job is mostly setting a tone, building coalitions to advance policy priorities and lobby for budget allocations, and dealing with all the bureaucracy of implementing and enforcing state and federal policies. Jill Gaskell, a member of the Pecatonica School Board who's worked with Underly for 7 years, says Underly has a talent for getting a lot of people on board with creative solutions to district problems.
She's just really good that way. I have seen the passion that she works with and her abilities. And I had no doubt that she is just going to shine.
Underly was endorsed by the state's largest teachers union, as well as many Wisconsin Democratic lawmakers. Her opponent, Deborah Kerr, has called her beholden to the union in debates and says voters should look for someone who can work with both Republicans and Democrats.
I have worked with legislators from both sides of the aisle at the state capitol and in Washington, D.C. at Capitol Hill. And so I think these experiences, these relationships are going to be critical moving forward.
The race has attracted hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign spending, primarily from liberal groups, which have backed Underly. They've outspent a pro-voucher group that's opposed Underly at a rate of 13-1. Other odds favor Underly as well. Candidates backed by liberal groups have tended to win the state superintendent seat. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, a recent survey says online hate and harassment is increasing for some people. We'll get the results and look at some possible solutions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, the Civilian Conservation Corps was a big part of the New Deal efforts during the Great Depression, and there are calls to bring back the concept in the 21st century. Find out why tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Now, every year, the Anti-Defamation League asks people if they've experienced hate or harassment online. This year's survey shows that online harassment is still a problem despite social media companies' recent attempts to crack down. As we're seeing an increase in attacks on Asian Americans, we'll look at the ways that real-world racism and hate can manifest online. We'll also hear what the Anti-Defamation League thinks governments and technology companies could do about the issue. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced or witnessed hate or harassment online? Was it specific to your race or identity? Were you satisfied with solutions available through the social media platform? And what questions do you have about potential solutions to online harassment? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Goldenberg is the Midwest Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
What stands out to you, David, as far as the big picture trends when it comes to online harassment and hate?
Well, Rob, as you mentioned earlier, this is the third consecutive year that ADL has conducted our national survey looking at online hate. And what we found overall is that, as you said before too, despite social media companies saying they're cracking down on it, it's not getting done. And we're seeing continued hate and harassment that's being spread and manifesting across social media. We found across the board that 41% of Americans experienced some type of online harassment. 35% were subjected to offensive name calling. 27%, nearly one in every three, had experienced severe online harassment. And when we looked at it too, we found that nearly half of people were being attacked and harassed online because of their political views, a third of them because of their physical appearance, and 28% of them because of race and ethnicity. This is a plague on our society. It's a plague on social media, and it has to be addressed.
Sometimes I think when people talk about online harassment, there's an idea that, well, that's just online stuff. It's not a real world problem that we need to take as seriously. What would you say to that response to your findings?
I'd say they're wrong. Online and social media and the internet has been used over the last few years, especially as a very important medium for haters to spread their hateful message from extremists, from white supremacists, from even politicians who are spreading conspiracy theories. And we have seen all too often organizing online. We have seen instances where people have become adapted, or I should say people have become overcome, or people have become influenced, by what they're reading and viewing online. And it has helped mold their extremist views. And in many cases, they've taken action.
Looking at the demographics of the people who report experiencing online harassment and hate, who seems to be hardest hit in this last year?
Yeah, so what we found is that, as I mentioned, is such a significant portion of people were being attacked by their identity. Asian Americans experienced the largest single rise year over year in severe online hate and harassment, going up from just 11% in 2019 to 17% who reported severe harassment this past year. And fully half of all Asian American respondents who were harassed reported that their harassment was because of their race. We also saw a sharp rise in online harassment of African Americans based on their race from 42% the year before to 59% this past year. And both of those, if you think about it, are layered with the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and too many other Black individuals at the hands of police officers that we saw last year. And with Asian Americans, we saw it at a time where there was a spike in xenophobia and xenophobia directed toward Asian Americans as a result of them being scapegoated for the spread of COVID.
Talking to David Goldenberg, Midwest Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League. A new report from that organization looks at harassment and hate in the online world and offers potential solutions. And I want to spend some time on potential solutions, David. And let's start with the online platforms themselves, the Facebooks and Twitters and others of the world. What kind of changes do you see them potentially making that you think would put a dent in this problem?
Social media platforms have played an incredibly important role in changing the way that we communicate with one another, getting information, sharing updates about our lives, reconnecting with old friends. But at the same time, they also have these algorithms that are used for marketing purposes, and algorithms that have been used and we have shown and exposed that are being used to spread hate, hateful messages, hate symbols, and conspiracies. Social media platforms can use those same algorithms that they use when you and I search for a new pair of shoes and we see it in every possible website and app that we look at in the future, just like they use those algorithms to target users from a marketing perspective, they can use it to identify and suppress hate. And we know that they can do it because we've seen it. And we've seen that when social media platforms crack down on hate and conspiracies on their platforms, you see dramatic decreases in the manifestation and the spread of those hateful messages. For example, Facebook finally, after years of critiques by ADL and others, finally took action and pulled down a slew of pages that were spreading QAnon conspiracies. And within 2 weeks of those being pulled, we saw more than 70% decline in the spread of some of those conspiracies. So we know that when you remove them from social media platforms, when you remove these hateful messages, you can have a positive impact on the spread of hate.
I want to key in on those algorithms a little bit, David, because it's not just that somebody puts a hateful thing on a platform. If I go looking for it, I can find it myself. In the report, you talk about the ways in which, you know, once you look at something at all political on either extreme, the way that the platform gets more attention, gets you to keep clicking, is to serve up more and more extreme things, really in some ways highlighting some of the things you're worried about. Can you talk about how that works and how those same algorithms, as you just said, might be used to turn that to make that not happen?
Absolutely. We know that algorithms serve marketing purposes. We as users of social media platforms are ultimately how social media platforms make money. Those advertising, those marketing abilities, and the fact that somebody, they can get a company, can get their advertisement in front of you or me, Rob, or any of your users, is how social media platforms make their money. It's their business model. And in many cases, they are disincentivized by their business model to pull down some of these advertisements or these promoted conspiracies. But what we know, though, is that when you click on something, whether you be watching a video on YouTube or you click on a video of any of your favorite show, let's say, we all then can see those recommended shows that come next are ones that are in the same genre, in the same type of profile of what you just clicked, because they know you've self-identified of being interested in a comedy. So they're going to recommend other comedies. Well, what we found is that the same thing happens with extremists and extreme views. Those algorithms kick in. ADL recently worked with one of our partners through the Center for Technology and Society, which ADL runs. And what we found was that we looked at almost 1,000 YouTube accounts. And we had people click on one video that had some type of extremist ideology, some type of extremist message on it, and they were more than less likely to have in their recommended list of videos another type of extremist related video. And if you clicked on two, it more than tripled those numbers. So what it tells you is that in many ways, when you click on one of these videos, when you click on a link or of what you think is a newspaper article on your social media platform, you often get sent down a rabbit hole. And you've self-identified, I'm interested in this, even if you're not. And what we find even too is that even if you are sharing an article or a meme and condemning it in your post, it still gets in front of more people. And in many ways, the algorithm still kicks in on your profile, and you're going to be more likely to see those types of posts pop up in your social media feeds, in your advertising online as well.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Jim on the line in Darlington. Jim, hi.
Hi. Hi. I find that the whole freedom of speech thing is so troubling, isn't it, when you're trying to limit what people can hear and stuff. I get offended virtually every day listening to NPR because even though I'm not a racist, I am a white male, and I'm portrayed as one constantly, day after day. Now you want to limit my view, but we can have every extreme leftist view on earth is fine. They don't ever seem to get taken off.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. So Jim's saying he doesn't want to see people's free speech limited online. He's worried if Facebook, say, is dropping conspiracy theory groups, they might also get political groups that he is in support of. They might be taking them offline, too.
So Jim's touching on a really important issue, right? So where does the First Amendment fit in all of this? And one of the things that makes America great is that people can stand from their rooftops and shout out views that we can't stand. But that's what makes our country great. But what becomes really important here in this particular conversation to understand is that social media platforms are private companies. They're private entities. They're not public. They're not units of government. They're not public spaces. They are private companies. Their platform itself is a private company. And they have an option, or they have the ability to suppress hateful messages and conspiracies and false and misleading information and extremist views that we know that are inciting hate, and inciting hate not with an S, but inciting hate with a C. And you know, those user agreements that we all click on quickly whenever we open up a new social media platform, there are certain agreements that we commit to as to how we're going to use their platform and what type of behavior is permissible on their platform. So a social media company could very easily write into their user profiles that it's not, that their platform is not going to be used to spread false and misleading information, known conspiracies, extremist hateful views that are used to incite people. And when individuals violate those user agreements, which we willingly enter into, then they have the authority and standing to say, no, you cannot use my platform in this particular way. We know that social media platforms are being used to spread hate. We know that they're also being used by extremists to organize. We know that Kyle Rittenhouse, the shooter down in Kenosha during the protests of the shooting of Jacob Blake, we know that he was organized through a Facebook meetup group that then ultimately brought him across the border from Illinois to Wisconsin, that led him ultimately to shoot two innocent protesters. We know that social media platforms were used to organize insurrection of the Capitol prior to and even during the insurrection on January 6th, where people were live streaming themselves inside the Capitol, and they were getting instructions on how to move from one room to another room, to find the floor of the Senate or the floor of the House, for example. Social media platforms can say, absolutely not, we will not allow our platform to be used. And the question just is not, it's not a question of can they, it's a question of will they.
We're talking to David Goldenberg, Midwest Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League. We're looking at the results of the 2021 Online Hate and Harassment Survey and possible solutions to the problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see government or technology companies work to stop online harassment? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with David Goldenberg of the Anti-Defamation League. Their 2021 survey of online harassment is out. We're finding out who's hit hardest by online threats and intimidation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Staying with the online platforms and what they can do, David, another recommendation in the report has to do with their policy when somebody reports to them hate or harassment or other troubling activity. What do we see in how those complaints, those concerns are handled?
Well, ADL has some recommendations in our report, but we also, a few months ago, we had put out what we call a report card of how well social media platforms respond to complaints of hate and harassment. And we found the one platform that we gave up, no one got an A. The one platform that got a B was Twitch. But we had Facebook and Discord and a number of others that we gave Ds to. TikTok and YouTube ultimately received, and Twitter ultimately received Cs. But we find that in general, when you write or file a complaint with these social media platforms, number one, it's virtually impossible to get a real person who will work with you. And second of all, it takes extremely long times for them to be responsive. And ultimately, that the notification that they provide to you or to the individual with specificity as to why you've been removed or why a post has been taken down virtually doesn't exist. I mean, of the nine platforms that we looked at, only four of them respond within 24 hours. and other issues, things like Holocaust denial, only two of them actually take action against that. And so there are those types of things that are real factual events that social media companies know you have conspiracies being spread around about them on their platforms, and they're just not doing enough about it.
Another recommendation has to do with police training. And I've seen over the years, people share accounts of when they've been receiving actual threats of violence that may end up being criminal. They go to a police department, and understandably, a police agency might not know how to handle this thing. It's a threat from someone somewhere, not in their jurisdiction even. What kind of things would you like to see change there?
It's a really hard thing for law enforcement in many ways because of, number one, the anonymity that exists on the internet, and number two, because of departments that don't have as many resources or skilled professionals who know how to deal with these types of issues. Often, even in some of the largest departments, whether it be Milwaukee or Madison or Green Bay or some of the, or you know, even larger departments of some of the largest ones in the country, they don't have people on staff who are adequately trained, or they don't have enough resources to deal with it. And so you get into smaller cities and smaller jurisdictions, they absolutely don't necessarily know how to do it. So ADL, one of the things that we are doing is going around the country and offering what we call hate crimes training for law enforcement. Now, not all states have adequate hate crimes laws in place as it relates to cyber hate. And that is a big part of ADL's legislative initiatives over the course of the next few years, is that we would like to see states have adequate laws on the books that give law enforcement and prosecutors the ability to go after people who are harassing and threatening others online. So just like we have hate crimes laws in Wisconsin and around the country and 46 other states, we want to make sure that we have cyber hate laws on the books too, so that those who are threatening and those who are harassing others online can ultimately be held accountable.
In our last minute or two, you know, I think a lot of times people who are online might see this happening, someone harassing someone else. Do you have thoughts for online bystanders and the role they can play?
I think the most important thing is there's three things. Number one, you got to speak up. You got to say something about it and not allow hate or threats to go by unanswered. Number two, you have to share facts. When you see false information, misleading information, conspiracies that ultimately are being pushed by your friends, by your family members, or others just on social media, you have to respond by sharing facts and responding to them with facts. And lastly, showing strength. It's really important when communities are threatened, when communities are attacked, when individuals are attacked, that we all come together to say, this is unacceptable. We're not going to allow this platform to be a place for hate. We're not going to allow you to spread your hateful messages, because that ultimately is how we're going to be able to take and push these extremists and these haters back into the hole from which they came.
And very briefly, David, do you see these issues being taken more seriously, maybe since the beginning of this year even?
Absolutely. People are seeing and realizing the real life impact of online hate and online organizing of extremists and the impact they can have in real life examples. We know, for example, that the shooters in some of the most extreme and horrific hate-driven attacks, things like the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, the shooting in Poway, the AME church in Charleston, Christchurch Mosque in New Zealand, none of those shooters were card-carrying members of extremist groups. Instead, they were people who were inspired online through hateful messages and ideologies and symbols, who then ultimately made a decision to take action where they went and committed mass murders, targeting people because of their religion and their identities, but they were greatly inspired and had direct ties and strong profiles online in these extremist chat rooms. And so we know in those cases that people can be inspired online to take real life action that has incredibly dramatic and sometimes violent and worse outcomes.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to David Goldenberg from the Anti-Defamation League, looking at a survey on online harassment. Tomorrow on Central Time, the Biden administration is calling for a tax increase on corporations and high-income Americans. We'll look at the impact of that and more tomorrow on Central Time. It's April Fool's Day. I'm not big on the pranks, and for a variety of reasons, it might be harder than usual to play pranks on people this year. But not to worry, here's a list of pranks you can play on yourself, generated by artificial intelligence algorithms. These, like so many funny neural network things that we sometimes feature on the show, come from the AI Weirdness website created by researcher Janelle Shane. Try these self-pranks at home. Repaint your nails in an unusual color like orange and just leave them like that. Stand in line for a movie for 30 minutes and then leave. Putting your car keys in the freezer and forgetting where you put them. I wouldn't put that one past myself in a moment of absent-mindedness. Take it to the next level. Make an appointment with yourself. Say you're going to clean up your mess and go for a run. Block out a day for it. And for goodness sake, don't clean anything and absolutely do not go for a run. Install a fake microwave on the wall that you never use. Set up a freezer in your freezer, then put a sign on it that says freezer burn. Put your name on a balloon. Surprise! Sleep in the rafters of a converted school bus in Pewaukee, Wisconsin. It's weirdly specific. And this one, I played this prank on myself this morning. Make your own coffee. Happy April Fool's Day or Poisson d'Avril for our French-speaking listeners. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.